Has this question ever been raised, whether a U.S. president could be a Russian agent? Apparently, the question has been raised now with this president. On Insight, I'll talk with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, about the FBI's counterintelligence investigation as reported in the New York Times. There's much more that we'll cover in our conversation as well. Tuesday is the deadline for open enrollment under Covered California to be covered by February 1st. That's the state's insurance marketplace under the Affordable Care Act. The new governor has proposed changes to health insurance in the state. I'll talk about that. And the deadline with Covered California's executive director, Peter Lee. Later in the hour, the top 15 foods that you should eat in 2019. I do not think you're going to guess what's number one on this list. It's a fruit, but it's not blueberries. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. The ongoing partial federal government shutdown would have been the top national political story today, but the New York Times reporting of a counterintelligence investigation against President Trump is getting even more attention. When has the question been asked? Could the U.S. president be working with Russia against national security? That's where we are going to start with Ken Rudin today. He is the political junkie. He's joining us, as he does nearly every week, from Washington, D.C. Hi, Ken. This is a conversation, though, that we have not ever had before.
I woke up Saturday, looked at the front page. Good morning, Beth. I woke up Saturday, looked at the front page of the New York Times, and the headline said, FBI investigated if Trump worked for the Russians. The thought of that, I remember, but Robert Welch, who was the head of the John Birch Society back in the 1950s, he called President Eisenhower a conscious, dedicated agent of the communist, conspiracy. Huh. But that was Robert Welch and the John Birch Society, which, of course, everybody was a communist to them. But to see that the FBI is investigating whether the president of the United States is working for Russia against American interests, if you ever wonder why there's a Robert Mueller investigation, I mean, this is a perfect example why. It is unheard of in ever, and it's just absolutely remarkable.
So maybe nothing will come of that, but what's the impact of, as you said, waking up and seeing that headline, of the fact that this is the prevailing story, of the fact that there's even the suggestion that the president of the United States has undermined national security?
Well, I mean, I think that is part of the Mueller investigation, the fact that you have Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign chairman, who his lawyers inadvertently revealed that he leaked polling information to people associated with Russian intelligence figures back during the 2016 campaign. I mean, basically, that's what Mueller is doing. Trump could talk about no collusion all you want, but when you have Manafort releasing poll data to the Russians, when you have Donald Trump Jr. and Manafort and Jared Kushner meeting at Trump Tower with a woman alleged to have links to the Kremlin offering dirt on Hillary Clinton, I mean, if I looked in the dictionary, to me, that looks like the word, what the definition of collusion is. And so I don't know how close we are to hearing from Robert Mueller. I suspect we're closer than we have been. And I think the reason I think it might be close is because Rod Rosenstein had announced that he's going to be leaving soon. I don't think he would leave soon if that weren't the case. But I think this is all part of the case that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, is trying to bring against Trump and people associated with him.
I do want to get back to what the New York Times said, and that was that there were two investigations happening. Now, we know about the criminal investigation that had to do with the firing of FBI Director James Comey, and that was regarding obstruction of justice. This new aspect is the counterintelligence elements. Now, they were all rolled into one investigation, but let's spend a little bit more time on the difference, on this counterintelligence aspect of what the FBI was looking at.
Well, I mean, to my best of my understanding of it, there were people associated with the president, like Carter Page, like perhaps Manafort, who had ties with pro-Russian people in Ukraine, that people who worked for him were basically doing Putin's bidding. And, you know, when we saw that famous scene in Helsinki, when the president's standing next to Putin and he says, and basically he's asked whether he believes his own intelligence agencies or he believes Putin. I mean, so, and he said, well, Putin wouldn't, you know, I don't think he lied to me. These are the kind of questions we've heard for at least the 2 years he's been president and perhaps sometime before, that he seems to go out of his way not to disparage Putin and what the Russians are doing, and more disparaging of U.S. allies and Republicans in Congress and Democrats in Congress. So I mean, whether there's a difference between a political investigation or an actual intelligence investigation, it seems like the target is the same thing, whether he did act to subvert American foreign. Look, anybody who says we should, you know, I'm not a fan of NATO and we should end these alliances and they're not working with France, Germany, and Britain, but he wants to have closer relationships with Russia. I mean, I don't know what you want to call it, but it certainly seems like the president is offering a different agenda than any other president has ever offered.
The New York Times reports in the article, Ken, that no evidence has emerged publicly that Mr. Trump was secretly in contact with or took direction from Russian government officials. That's a line I read directly from the story. And there was no comment from an FBI spokeswoman or a spokesman for the special counsel's office on this. So we are left with a lot of questions. Part of the story surrounding this, the ripple effect of all of this, is that there's been discussion about whether the president wanted to take control of and or destroy notes from translators in his meeting with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Also, we should talk about the new attorney general and whether the possibility of recusement might emerge with him.
Well, I assume you're talking about William Barr, whose confirmation hearings begin tomorrow. With a Republican majority in the Senate, it's very unlikely that he will be denied confirmation. But having said that, it was reported that Donald Trump asked Barr, who was the Attorney General under the first President Bush, he asked Barr to represent him as his attorney to defend him against the Russian investigation. So if you're going to ask William Barr to defend you against charges about cozying up to Russia, and then you appoint him as Attorney General, I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, look, I don't know if he will recuse himself. I don't know if he would do what Jeff Sessions did. But my goodness, you know that the Democrats will ask questions during the confirmation hearing. So wait a second. If Trump wanted you to defend him against charges about conspiring with Russia, how could you be a fair and independent attorney general? We will watch those questions and those answers very carefully when the confirmation hearings begin tomorrow.
The president repeated over and over that Jeff Sessions didn't inform him, the president, in advance about the recusement. So I do wonder whether that kind of conversation is ongoing now in this case, whether they're talking about it in advance.
Well, I assume, I mean, look, I assume that the president knows exactly what Barr has, what Barr's background is and what relationship he has with all of this. So I think he knows what he's getting, but I suspect he knew what he was getting with Sessions as well. I don't think he knew that Sessions would recuse himself, which seemed to be the right thing to do. But as you say, once Sessions recused himself, Comey appointed Rod Rosenstein, and that began the whole special counsel of Robert Mueller. So it had unintended consequences. I think he's getting a more certain ally in William Barr, but the Democrats may have something to say about that.
I'm talking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. He is in the Washington, D.C. area under a blanket of white. You had quite a big snowstorm over the last night plus, correct?
Oh, I thought you were talking about Trump's racial policies. No, I'm sorry. I shouldn't make jokes like that. Yes,
ooh.
10 inches or more of snow. It's gorgeous from the window, but it's not so gorgeous when you're on the road. And I didn't mean to throw out a silly racial comment about the blanket of white, but it reminds me of what's going on with Steve King, the congressman from Iowa, the Republican congressman from Iowa, who once again talked about, you know, white integrity and white, you know, he talked about all that stuff that is basically racially insensitive that the Republicans are having a fit with.
It's not that I'm going to help you out of what you just said, Ken, but let's expand on that a little bit, because Steve King represents Iowa's 6th District, and he did say that phrases like white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? That was part of his quote. So Let's go to some of the exchange with California Congressman Kevin McCarthy, who was the House Majority Leader, now the House Minority Leader. He is a Republican. Let's listen to a little bit of the exchange on Face the Nation, and you'll hear McCarthy first.
That language has no place in America. That is not the America I know, and it's most definitely not the party of Lincoln.
Should he be punished for it?
I have a scheduled meeting with him on Monday, and I will tell you this. I've watched on the other side that they do not take action when their members say something like this. Action will be taken. I'm having a serious conversation with Congressman Steve King on his future and role in this Republican Party.
So that's Congressman McCarthy. Representative Steve Scalise from Louisiana added that he imagines that House Republicans are going to continue talking about taking action against Steve King. Comments like that from Steve King are not new, but wouldn't you say, Ken, that this attention on those comments is at a different level?
Yes, and first of all, let me just say one thing. I'm not going to get into a fight with you. Of course, I would never get in a fight with you, but you don't have to bail me out of a comment like that, because just yesterday, Donald Trump tweeted something that quoted a Pat Buchanan from a Pat Buchanan column talking about white genocide. The fact is, there have been these dog whistles to white supremacy going on quite some time. So that silly joke about white snow, you shouldn't joke about any kind of racial controversies, but there's no question that there are these whistles from the president, from Steve King, from others in the Republican Party. The question is, yes, it's very nice for Kevin McCarthy now in the minority to talk about, well, action will be taken against Steve King, and maybe, you know, they'll review some of his committee assignments. But Steve King has been saying this for quite some time, and when the Republicans were in the majority, aside from very, very few Republicans, no Republican in power stood up and said Steve King has got to cease and desist. Now, what Steve King said about white nationalism and white supremacy is crossing a line, but there are some people who think that he's been crossing a line for some time, and this is a little bit too little and perhaps too late for the Republicans to suddenly realize that Steve King says offensive language.
And the reason they're talking about those discussions beginning today is that Congress is coming back later today. I think a lot of the government is shut down because of the weather. Of course, we're under this partial government shutdown anyway, but Congress returning to the Hill, I guess I'm confused about how much work is actually going to happen there today.
Well, it's not even because of the shutdown. It's because, I mean, basically, it seemed like everybody's on hold because of the shutdown. The fact is, the Republican Senate majority, especially led by Mitch McConnell, is doing basically everything they can to stay out of it. Mitch McConnell says, I want, you know, it's between the President Trump and the Democrats, which is kind of interesting. But I think in defense of Mitch McConnell, I think one of the reasons McConnell doesn't want to get involved is I don't think he really knows what President Trump wants or what he believes in, because sometimes Trump will say something on the shutdown, for example, about Dreamers or DACA or something like that. He'll say it on one day, and then the next day he'll say something completely different. So maybe some Republicans are waiting for the Trump versus Trump debate to be resolved before Mitch McConnell gets involved. But right now, look, in last month, the Republican Senate, led Senate voted unanimously. It was a voice vote, basically to reopen the government and temporarily fund it through February. And 2 days later, Trump, who had given his okay to that vote, suddenly changed his mind because he was hearing from Republican conservatives saying he was selling out the conservative cause. So, you know, it's hard for Mitch McConnell to know what Trump wants, and that's one of the reasons I think he's just staying quiet for now.
Let me add Senator Lindsey Graham's comments to this discussion, because he had said previously, Mr. President, declare a national emergency now, build a wall now. But let's listen to what Lindsey Graham said on Fox News over the weekend.
Before he pulls the plug on the legislative option, and I think we're almost there,
I would urge him to open up the government for a short period of time, like 3 weeks, before he pulls the plug, see if we can get a deal. If we can, at the end of 3 weeks, all bets are off. See if he can do it by himself through the emergency powers.
All right, so that's a signal that the doors are opening on how can we navigate some ending here that maybe, what, is something for each side?
Well, it's my understanding that Trump disavowed what Lindsey Graham said over the weekend. I think Trump said, sorry, that's a non-starter. He's not going to, temporarily open the government. So he's not doing that. So even somebody like Lindsey Graham, who has become a steadfast Trump defender, when he's dismissed by the president, it's hard to see anybody changing the president's mind unless the Democrats caved in completely and gave him his $5.7 billion for the wall.
And one more regional connection to that, I think this is happening across the country, as the president has suggested that there could be funding for other arenas like flood control protection in the Sacramento arena that could be pulled for border control efforts or building of the wall. That has set a lot of consternation, agitation in motion. Congresswoman Doris Matsui, among others, press releasing and blasting the president for those comments, saying that it's unconscionable that, in this case, Sacramento's flood protection funding would be taken away to build the border wall. I think that's another thing the president is dealing with in terms of members of Congress dealing with their constituencies in these proposals.
Well, I wonder if it's a slap at California, and maybe it's like Nancy Pelosi, you want to stand up to me? I'll take away this flood fund and this fire funding. But basically, he's endangering a lot of states like Texas, like Florida, like Puerto Rico, for their kind of trying to recover from the traumas that all these areas did. But look, he is single-minded from the moment he announced his candidacy. He is single-minded to start deciding that border security and the border wall is all important. He tried the gambit that Mexico will pay for it. Obviously, that was going nowhere. And now he's saying that Congress should pay for it. And if that goes nowhere, you know, I could see him using these emergency powers. But the fact that he will single out, I mean, in the scheme of things, is $5.6 billion that much money that you have to pull away from flood control and fire control and rescue efforts? I mean, that just sounds more petulant and more punitive than anything else. But I don't know how else to describe it.
A few more comments with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, on this Monday. Looks like California Senator Kamala Harris is going to jump into the presidential race. It's not final, but I'm seeing that she is planning a stop in Columbia, South Carolina at the end of this month. That's an early nominating state. So when that becomes official, it won't be any surprise, will it?
No, I don't think it'll be a surprise. Look, very few freshman senators write books, and if they're not planning, to run for president, she has a new book out, The Truths We Hold,
yes.
And she's on a nationwide book tour right now. And the expectation with more and more this is going to be a gigantic field, maybe the biggest since, 1984, 1976, whatever. It's going to be double digits. And so I kind of think that you wait, you snooze, you lose. And with a whole bunch of people either already announcing or people who are announcing exploratory committees, Elizabeth Warren has an exploratory committee, Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, said she, on CNN this weekend, that she's going to announce this week. Julian Castro, the former San Antonio mayor, announced his candidacy over the weekend. There's going to be so many, and I guess you just, this is the time to do it. It's a year to go. Next month will be 1 year to Iowa caucuses. And, sometimes Iowa, doesn't matter if you win in Iowa, that won't guarantee anything, but a loss can set you back. And so when the fact is that, given the fact that there's a large a large minority population in South Carolina, the fact that there's a large liberal constituency in Iowa, it only makes sense that Kamala Harris will announce sooner than later. It's my understanding that it will be in January. I mean, who knows? But it's my guess that she does announce before the end of the month. But she's going to join a very, very large field.
A lot of speculation that it'll be surrounding the Martin Luther King weekend with a holiday, and that's coming up this next weekend. So just a quick answer to this, Ken. Do you think a number of these people are jumping in right now with their real goal being 2024, not 2020?
That's always a question, either 2024 or maybe becoming vice president on the ticket. Who knows? But I kind of think that with no obvious front runner, we don't know what Joe Biden is doing. We don't know what Beto O'Rourke is doing. With no obvious front runner, it can't hurt to get into the mix. And you're absolutely right. Either positioning themselves for 2024 or getting on the ticket as VP.
Okay, final question. Are you keeping your eye on the moves and the announcements by California's new governor, Gavin Newsom? We had a budget message last week, and there were going to be a lot of indicators about how this governor was going to govern compared to Jerry Brown based on that budget announcement.
This is fascinating. I mean, Jerry Brown, it's a great topic. We've talked about this so much on your show that Jerry Brown has done. It was very, very careful. That probably infuriated a lot of liberals that he did not want a big spending push, even though he did get California into the positive territory, you know, a surplus. And he's very proud of that. He and people like him may be a little nervous about Newsom wanting to spend more than Jerry Brown would have liked to have done. It'll be interesting to see the differences between, just because they're two Democrats, and you know, Democrats don't always succeed themselves in California. I think that hasn't happened in over 100 years,
right,
that a Democratic governor succeeded a Democratic governor. But it'll be very interesting to see the difference in style and policies and certainly spending proclivities between Newsom and Brown.
Well, his budget projects a $21.4 billion surplus at this point, a 4% spending increase. So, okay, that's another story to be continued, as with almost everything we talked about in these last 20 minutes. All right. Thank you, Ken. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Beth. I'm sure things will be crazier next week.
All right. That is Ken Rudin, the political junkie, and you're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Open enrollment for Covered California continues only through Tuesday, January 15th. That's if you want to have coverage in place by February 1st. So that means this is the time to sign up or change plans in Californians' insurance plan under the Affordable Care Act. On the phone to talk us through this deadline, and we're going to talk about some of the news that you might have been hearing about health insurance in the state. It's Peter Lee on the phone. He is Covered California's executive director. Always a pleasure to have him join us. Hi, Peter. Thanks for making time again for Insight.
My pleasure to be with you, Beth.
So there have been judges' decisions and news stories on a national level about the Affordable Care Act. Let's start with some clarity. Are any of those decisions or announcements impacting Covered California right now as we go into a new year?
Yeah, absolutely not. Both the district court case in Texas has a long way to go to get to the Supreme Court. The government shutdown doesn't touch us. Californians need to know that, you know, we're open for business, and if you sign up for coverage now, you're going to be locked into great coverage for all of 2019.
Let's talk about the individual mandate that was part of the original Affordable Care Act. Talk about what the federal government did and how it's on the radar of the new governor in California.
Yeah, one of the sort of core elements woven into the Affordable Care Act was a penalty, that if you could afford coverage and chose not to get it, you'd be subject to a penalty administered by the IRS that ranged from $700 up to thousands of dollars. The Republican administration and Congress took that away. So as of 2019, there is no penalty. Now, we think that's actually causing a dip in our enrollment this year, about 10% off what we were last year, because on the margins, some healthier people are saying, I'll roll the dice and you know, go without insurance because I don't have a penalty. Well, now, I say often that the real penalty isn't writing a check to the IRS. It's showing up in a hospital and walking out owing, you know, $100,000. But that said, one of the things we saw with Governor Newsom is in his first day in office, he proposed a suite of health care reforms, one of which was to institute a California-based penalty, like some other states have done, But I think it's really important to note that what the governor did is not just propose a penalty, but to marry that penalty with increasing subsidies for middle-class Californians. I think he really understands the issue. It's about encouraging people to do the right thing, but also giving Californians that need more financial help a leg up.
Let's go into the math a little bit. If the state imposes an individual mandate, what to you is the dollar figure of millions that would be generated by that? And then we'll go further into the subsidies part of the equation.
Yeah, ballpark, in the neighborhood of $400 to $500 million would be generated. That's what the IRS raised in 2016 when they administered the penalty for the feds. So it's real money. If that penalty were kicked in 2020, that money wouldn't come in until 2021. But that amount of money actually could translate into real financial support. In particular, I just want to know that what Governor Newsom has proposed to do is, for the first time, provide subsidies for people that make over 400% of poverty, which are middle-class folks, in particular in the Bay Area. And if you're older, you're getting hit with huge premiums. And this would address people in Sacramento and other high-cost areas actually getting financial help.
Let's take this right to going online, for example, and shopping for a plan. If I am in that middle-class family group and I shop for a plan right now, and let's choose the silver plan because that's the one that's considered the most affordable, what might my premium look like? And then apply this subsidy idea and tell me what kind of an adjustment I might experience.
We'll see. Now, Beth, you're talking to me like one of my incredibly able customer service folks that can walk you through every one of these elements. And I have to note, it depends so much on your age, the size of your family, how much you make. But I'll talk in rough numbers.
Okay.
First, the silver plan is what we call the sort of the basic plan, which is it provides really good coverage. It's the plan where none of your outpatient care is subject to a deductible, which means you show up at the doctor, you're going to get first dollar coverage. There's a cheaper plan, the bronze plan, which is more high deductible. But that silver plan, and I'm guessing, let's say you're a family of two and you're older and you make $70,000 or $71,000, which means you make too much money to get any financial help. If you're two people in your 50s living in the Sacramento area, your premium might be $1,000. With financial help, that might cut it in half, $500. And remember, the middle-class folks in the individual market are the only Americans left that don't get a financial leg up. You get health care through your job, you get a leg up. You get Medi-Cal, a leg up. Medicare, a leg up. And what Governor Newsom has said is that just because there's an arbitrary line in the sand of $70,000 for a family of two doesn't mean health care becomes magically affordable. Let's help people out.
At this point, I want to clarify, just as we did at the beginning with national news and national stories, the new governor is talking about the ideas he did on the campaign trail, he did in his inaugural address, and now in the budget message. But are any of those changes happening yet in this new year?
No, they're not. And that's really important to note, is that what the governor's proposed is he's proposed his budget and elements that will require legislative action. And so, you know, California will need the legislature with the governor to enact a penalty in California and the subsidies that would be married with that. There are a number of things he did that you can do as governor out of the gate through executive orders. And he did two actions that take effect immediately. One, he did an executive order to establish an office of the Surgeon General. And this is where the governor wants to put a spotlight on issues of health disparities, the issues of how to promote social determinants that are actually having education and housing that really affect health care. He can do that day one, and he did. The second thing he did that he can do without anyone, you know, doing a sort of a check on that is ordered his Department of General Services to work with the other big healthcare purchasers in the public sector, like Medi-Cal, like Covered California, like Corrections, to say, what can we do to bring down pharmacy costs, drug costs for all Californians? And he issued an executive order saying, in short order, he wants a report on what we could do to lower pharmacy drug costs. So those are what, you know, any governor you know, is part of a broader structure. He took two executive orders, and the other elements will need to be worked out with the legislature in the weeks and months to come.
He has talked about a single-payer system for health insurance overall in the state, campaigned on that. He has since maybe in some ways walked that back, saying that would be a massive change to the system. It could be very expensive. It would take a lot of time. In your role as executive director of Covered California, to what degree do you get involved in those bigger conversations? And I guess, where is your role in terms of lobbying for any of these proposals?
Yeah, our role is to not lobby an iota. Covered California is an independent state agency. We actually don't report to the governor. We serve the state broadly, reporting to a five-member board, which is appointed by both the legislature and the governor. That said, we very much are actively involved in providing technical assistance both to the governor and to the legislature. And an example of that is on February 1st, we're going to be issuing a report on different options to make healthcare more affordable for Californians. We were charged with that by the legislature. We'll be coming out with that report. You know, I would note, though, that on the issue of, you know, how far do you go with single payer and different elements to get to true universal coverage, one of the other things the governor did on day one in office was send a letter to both President Trump, but also the leadership of Congress, Senate and House of Representatives, Republicans and Democrats, saying he wants Congress to give California the ability to take federal resources and make a solution that works for California. And I think that what that demonstrated is that Governor Newsom recognizes there's no such thing as a California solution without working with a ready partner at the federal level. And here's a model of what that might look like. So that showed not only leadership, but also pragmatism of there's no magical solution to healthcare as a California solution if you can't work with the federal government, Medicare dollars, Medicaid dollars, employer coverage. So he's really thinking long term and really constructively while he's looking at what can be done today.
The reason he's doing this, Peter, is because without federal subsidies of some sort, Covered California and other state-run exchanges essentially fall inward. They collapse, don't they?
Well, no question. I mean, but look, it's not just about Covered California and the subsidies that we provide to 1.2 million Californians, which is why, as you know, we're open for open enrollment right now for a day, one more day. But also, look at Medi-Cal in California. One-third of Californians under 65 have Medi-Cal as their source of insurance coverage. About 5 million newly covered with the Medicaid expansion, but every single one of those people are funded largely through a federal-state partnership. So you can't talk about healthcare in California without recognizing the integral role that the federal government has as providing financial support to make healthcare work.
So what is your thought, since you bring up Medi-Cal, about the governor's proposal to expand it and cover young immigrant adults who are in the United States?
Well, the main thing I'd note on that is, look, California has made phenomenal progress in reducing the rate of the uninsured. We were at 17% uninsured 6 years ago, 7 years ago. We're now at 7%. But of those 7%, more than half of them are undocumented. And look, we're at about 3% eligible uninsured. We're approaching universal coverage for people that are eligible for coverage. Without addressing the undocumented issue, you won't get to universal coverage. So this is an issue for the governor and the legislature to work out, but I understand where it's coming from, is that you want universal coverage, you need to look beyond the current pool who's been covered by our existing programs.
You're listening to Peter Lee. In 2011, he became California's first executive director for the state health benefit exchange that was set up under the Affordable Care Act. The ACA had been established in 2010. You're right, we need to talk about open enrollment because it ended for much of the rest of the country in December. California's in a small pool of marketplaces that are still open, right?
Absolutely. Well, there's about six states that are still open, and we are open until midnight tomorrow, Tuesday the 15th.
So that means you can sign up right now without meeting certain conditions. You can also change the plan that you're in. It is closing a little earlier than last year. That's something to point out, correct?
That's right. Last year we were open until the end of the month, but there's a good news about being closed a little bit sooner. Some people that waited till the last minute, as people always do, that meant last year you wait till January 31st, which you can't wait till this year, you wouldn't have gotten coverage till March. Now you sign up by midnight tomorrow, you're going to get coverage starting February 1. You're going to have 11 months of good coverage. And I mean, I'd remind her listeners here is that you've got a kid turning 26, you've got a nephew, an uncle, a cousin that you think may not have insurance. Now's the time to give them a call. Because if you decide to stand on the sidelines, you've got no insurance today, you don't sign up, and you come to ask for coverage in June, you might be told, sorry, you're out of luck. Wait till next year. But it is important to note, and Beth, you understand this well, but is that those special circumstances, look, if you've got employer-based coverage today and you lose your job in June, come on into Cover California. We're open year-round for people that have a change of circumstance. But circumstances don't change. You're uninsured today. Now's the time to get coverage and not get locked out of insurance.
You mentioned a 10% dip in enrollment. So how many people have signed up so far? How current are your numbers?
The numbers I have actually are as of a week or so ago, and we had over 1.4 million people, but the vast majority of them are renewing people that had coverage last year that signed up, again, to keep their coverage. It's about 250,000 people who have signed up newly this year. And one of the things to remember is the individual market that we serve, whether or not you get a subsidy, is where many people go for a year or two between jobs. So there's always a lot of turnover. It's not trying to get people insured that have been uninsured forever. And so we need to be out there and remind people that, you know, might have enrolled with us 5 years ago and then got a job and now are uninsured. So this is the time for anyone to talk to friends and neighbors because it's a churn market, as they say. People move in and out of the individual market.
Online, it's pretty easy. CoveredCA.com. That's coveredca.com. We'll post a link. There is a shop and compare tool that's pretty easy to use on the site. You want to describe how to navigate if you're at the very beginnings of this, Peter?
Yeah, thank you, Beth. And thanks for that endorsement of pretty easy. And it is pretty easy. In 1 minute, you go on to shop and compare, enter in your zip code, how old you are, how big your family is, and how much money you make. You'll get an immediate response of here's how much financial help you'll get, and here are the local private plans available for you in your area. It's that fast. But also, we know as easy as it is, and we think that the website's gotten a lot better, it's pretty easy to use. Health insurance can still be confusing. You go online and say, I want local help near me, put in your zip code, you'll get a Google map showing you local insurance agents right near you. They're ready. They'll be working all through late tomorrow night. Set up an appointment. Get help if you're a little bit confused.
And just to close this out with one more point, Peter, I think when the Affordable Care Act began, there might have been a perception about who it was for or in what circumstances it worked best. Now we're a number of years into it in California. What's the scope of populations and the type of people who are coming to Cover California for coverage? What's it become in its evolution?
Well, it really is a marketplace for everybody. And that's the most important thing to note is that, look, we have about 1.2 million Californians who get financial help. But about the same number, about a million who sign up either directly with Cover California or they go directly to health plan. They go direct to Kaiser, direct to Blue Shield. But when they go to those plans, they're getting plans that we've negotiated the price. We're making sure they're really good benefits so they're there when you need them. And the days of needing to worry about pre-existing conditions, thing of the past. So it really has been a total change of the health insurance marketplace that really is about having a program that works well for all Californians. And I think that's one thing. I just got to say, I listened to Governor Newsom when he released the budget answering reporters' questions about the individual penalty. His depth of understanding was so clear, recognizing the penalty. No one likes penalties. But it's the right thing to do, and it lowers cost for everybody, whether or not you get a subsidy. That's what we've created in California, a working market with private health plans that's working for everyone.
All right. Tomorrow night, January 15th at midnight is the deadline for open enrollment for Covered California to get your coverage in place by February 1st. Peter, it's always a pleasure, and I appreciate all the information that you covered with us. Thanks for giving us so much time today.
My pleasure, Beth. Have a great day. And remember, deadline tomorrow night at midnight. Thanks a lot.
You got it. We'll post a link. Peter Lee is the executive director of Covered California, and this is Insight on CAP Radio. Listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Would you believe me if I said that mangoes are at the top of at least one list of the foods that you should be eating in the new year? A mango is at the top of the list, and that particular list comes from UC Davis. So what is it about mangoes? And I want to know, I think you do too, what's on the rest of the list. So in the studio with me is Alex Nella, a registered dietitian at UC Davis Children's Hospital. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how's it going?
Point of clarification here. Because you're from the Children's Hospital, are the foods we're going to talk about recommended for kids, or is this a list for everybody?
This is definitely a list for everybody. You know, I might work in pediatrics, but this list was compromised from a lot of different professionals from specialties like orthopedics, ophthalmology, sports medicine, and oncology. I'm the pediatric part of the show.
You went around and surveyed. All right, how did mangoes end up at the top of the list?
Well, that was from one of our oncologists who was really excited about the perspective that everyone in the family can get behind mangoes. And it certainly comes from the earth. It's got antioxidants, vitamin A, vitamin C, a lot of potassium. You know, some kind of antioxidant has to give it that bright, vibrant color. So it hits a lot of our health needs from that perspective. It's not particularly in season right now.
Right.
Right now it's coming from Mexico. It is grown in California, but it's a summer fruit. And there are only two fruits on this list.
I notice.
Yeah. And they're both summer fruits, right? We got blueberries and mangoes. I'm not sure how mangoes got to the top of this list, but there they are. Both of them are really summer fruits.
Sometimes mangoes arrive in the store hard, and they can be intimidating. It's not necessarily a fruit that all of us are familiar with. I come from the Midwest. I can't remember how far into my 20s or 30s I was before I saw mango. So talk about the ripeness and eating a mango.
You know, as a dietitian, I think I'm still with you on some of the intimidation factor. What color is it supposed to be? I'm asking somebody. If I'm at the Co-op or Sprouts or Safeway, it doesn't matter. I'm probably asking them for a little suggestion. They're going to tell you, do I need to put this in a bag with some bananas so the ethylene from the bananas can help me ripen it up and get that texture we're looking for? Is there an aroma I'm looking for so I know when the right time is to cut into that? And cutting a mango, holy smokes, I'm probably YouTubing that. So I can get some ideas on how to best utilize that meat.
I know that, Alex. Longwise and scoop out those seeds.
There's a big old seed in there.
All right. We're spending a lot of time on mangoes, but number two on the list probably is not going to surprise anybody. Number two is, drum roll.
Eat less animals?
Number two is fish. Number two is fish on the list.
Sure. It's on there. Eat more fish. Some people might say chicken could show up on there. I have less animal protein on mine, and that's really coming from an oncologist who wants people to lower their heart disease risk and lower their stroke risk, diabetes, and obviously lower their cancer risk. It is not a coincidence that the World Health Organization lists red meat and processed meat as a stage one carcinogen. So it shouldn't be a surprise that we're encouraging people to get more active with plant-based protein or participate in a meatless Monday so they can lower that health risk for them long term.
A lot of people go to fish oil supplements now, and you have to watch the number of omega-3s in your supplement. But is that a good substitute for eating fish?
You know, I really err on the side of eating the real deal. Mm. A fatty fish, which would be something like salmon or tuna or mackerel.
Or trout.
Or once or twice a week, I would much rather have that because those come with other nutritional benefits. And it is murky sometimes to find a supplement that meets all those needs for us. Which of these oils am I looking for? Is it the DHA or the EPA? Is there a certain ratio I'm looking for? It's complicated out there. And I think you do want to find one with a little more DHA when possible. I think that's the higher one in the ratio we're looking for. You don't have to worry about that if you have 3 or 4 ounces of salmon in front of you.
Okay, just to this list in general, foods we should be eating in 2019, is this list different to you than previous lists? And by that I mean, do we know more now? Are we targeting specific better eating as humans?
You know, there's a lot of different perspectives on this list, and I think that's what makes this one unique, is the fact that we have all these different voices, on here. The foods on here are not game changers. They're not game breakers. They're not new to anybody. These are foods that our grandparents would have recognized as healthy foods that should
be true.
On your plate. Do we know more about these foods? I think we do, because, you know, one of the big things that I was a fan of on this list was broccoli or any cruciferous vegetable because of one antioxidant in particular called glucosinolates, which gets changed in our body to something called sulforaphane, which is a powerful detoxification antioxidant, activates something called the NRF2 pathway, which neutralizes antioxidation and free radicals, which is a lot of fancy words for anti-cancer.
All right, now we're way in the weeds. Anti-cancer.
Yeah, here we go.
Right.
But broccoli, broccoli sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts. I mean, those are what's really high in those particularly beneficial compounds. And that is research that started in the 90s that continues to get elucidated even now today in 2019. It's not uncommon to hear a nutrition researcher talking about that, say, on like the Joe Rogan podcast.
Yeah.
That's been really recent, 2018.
So under fish, broccoli, as you said, that group of vegetables, blueberries, which we mentioned, then beets, any color, red beets, yellow beets, golden beets, and then spinach and our leafy green vegetables. So really the core of this list is that whole vegetable group that gets talked about a lot. Kale is later on the list too.
Yeah, kale and spinach, really any leafy green. Why is that? Because anything that's leafy green is going to have lutein and zeaxanthin, which are some $100 words that really help eye health. Because once again, we have ophthalmology experts looking at this. And the two nutrients that are really concentrated in our macula are lutein and zeaxanthin. And we get a lot of those nutrients from the cooked versions of leafy greens. Kale being actually at the top of that, spinach being not too far down, and those two really helpful nutrients that prevent macular degeneration, prevent cataracts. And our ophthalmologists are really passionate about that, obviously.
You are listening to Alex Nella. He's a registered dietitian at UC Davis Children's Hospital. There are a couple items on this list that kids are going to love you for. Parents are going to love you because they're going to say, okay, my kids want this. I can give it to them. Peanut butter might seem like an obvious one, but also on the list, chocolate and chocolate milk.
They were surprising to a lot of people to make it on this list. Once again, it's a broad perspective from some people who are really interested in athletics, because chocolate milk is one of these readily available recovery drinks that in some cases are shelf stable. It certainly fits for a niche of endurance or even power athletes to have this kind of holy grail mix of a 3-to-1 carb to protein ratio that's perfect for recovery. Yeah, it is. It is milk with added sugar, but that's kind of the point. That's what an athlete might need to replace a lot of the carbohydrate that they burnt down, as well as having a protein source to build back some of those muscle fibers they broke down in hopes of building them back stronger. So chocolate milk makes it for that reason. Chocolate's on here, and I'll add some caveat on that one.
Okay.
If it mentions on that chocolate that it's used with alkali processing, we're dealing with milk chocolate here. Not a whole lot of nutritional benefits coming with that. You're probably looking for a dark chocolate of 70% cacao or higher, and portion control is going to be important with that. You're looking at 1 ounce a few times a week. If you want to have it every day, we're probably taking it down from an ounce. But yeah, we can certainly find some antioxidant capacity with dark chocolate, especially the higher up that percentage goes.
Some other foods on this list: almonds, quinoa, that tiny, tasty little grain, legumes, all kinds of beans, the chickpeas and other beans. And I'm going to wrap us up with number 15 on the list. If you put a pickle spear on the plate, you're doing good in 2019.
I got to smile when you say that because it made its way on here as our executive chef at the hospital, Santana Diaz. What do you do with some of these extra vegetables you have lying around? Well, you can really make them last to a time where you're not going to have some of those vegetables around by pickling them. Some of those things can be high in sodium, but it really is going to matter to your portion. Some of these things are really going to add a lot of flavor to your salad or whatever you're eating. And it's notable that this list has links to a couple of recipes, one of which being a chipotle pickled carrot recipe from our executive chef, Santana Diaz. So take a look at that.
We will post a link to that list. Do you have a favorite healthy snack yourself?
You know, peanut butter makes the list for me as well.
Yeah.
There's like not a day that goes by that I don't eat peanut butter with some kind of whole grain wrap. I'm about it.
Are we at the point yet where, as a whole population, we're getting healthier in our eating?
I think a lot of us are really more focused on it.
Mm.
But overall, we have a lot of work to do. I still have a job. I'm happy about that.
Thank you so much. The list was really fun. I think there's something on there for everybody. So I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you for having me.
That is registered dietitian at UC Davis Children's Hospital, Alex Nella. We'll post a link to the article, some of those recipes. You can find it all at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Cody Drabble and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones, and our executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back tomorrow with another live show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.